So our first case, the Crown bankruptcy case, Mr. Holman. Holman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Matt Holman, and I represent the appellants in this matter. Crown Stock Distribution, an appellant herein, sold its assets to Kevin E. Smith Enterprises for $6 million. The structure of that purchase was $3.1 million in cash paid at closing, with $2.9 million to be paid on a promissory note. The buyer operated a business with these assets, which the lower court determined were worth $4 million. The operation of the business lasted 3.5 years. The buyer ultimately filed bankruptcy. In the bankruptcy action, the buyer sold the assets for $3.7 million, and then the trustee, the appellee, filed an action for a fraudulent conveyance claiming that the transaction that occurred 3.5 years earlier was fraudulent. The lower court agreed and directed that the owners of Crown Stock Distribution and Crown Stock return all of the money that it received in the transaction, despite the fact that Crown Stock does not receive the assets in return and does not receive a credit for any of the value that's given to the debtor in the transaction.
Just let me ask you a few questions about that so I can make sure I have the basics down. What was the value of the consideration that Crown gave to the debtor?
The court found that the assets were worth no more than $4 million. The trustee's experts at trial testified that the trustee presented two experts. One stated that the value of the assets was $3.25 million, and the other one was testified it was $3.3 million. So that the amount that the debtor actually paid after paying two payments on the note to Crown was $3.3 million, the exact amount that the trustee's own expert said was received by the debtor.
Well, your argument is that because $2.9 million was in the form of a promissory note, that you maintain was essentially worthless, correct?
That is part of the argument. Yes, that's correct. And actually, the trustee maintained that the note was worthless as well.
But it's true that the note ultimately proved to be worthless. But isn't the question whether at the time of the transaction it was so obviously worthless as to not actually be considered as part of the transaction amount?
The time to determine what the value of the note would be is exactly right, Your Honor. It would be the time of the transfer. And the testimony from the trustee's own expert was that in the trustee's opinion, at the time of the transfer, the promissory note was absolutely worthless. In fact, his quote was, I would tell anyone who held that note that any penny you get on that is gravy.
Right.
So at the time of the transfer, the trustee took the position at trial that at the time of transfer, the assets, the buyer could not operate the business in a way that it could continue so it could pay the note. And the result of that is that the transaction ended up from a valuation standpoint, and this court has held on numerous occasions that in determining whether reasonably equivalent value was exchanged in the transaction, which is the first element of a fraudulent transfer action in both the bankruptcy code provision for fraudulent transfer and Indiana code provision for fraudulent transfer, is what to determine what the value actually transferred was.
The problem I have with your case is that Smith put up $500, and for that $500, he completely screws the unsecured creditors.
But
they get nothing because the loan from F&M is secured, and the promissory note is secured. So you've got $6 million. Dollars of secured debt. There's not a penny left for the unsecured creditors I don't have the figures. I couldn't figure out exactly, but seems to be about $1.5 million of unsecured debt when the transaction occurred. So why isn't that a complete abuse of the of the transactional process, to have an empty transaction where someone puts up nothing and ruins and deprives the unsecured creditors of everything. And the other thing is, apparently the unsecured creditors didn't know about this transaction. They thought they were dealing with the old Crown, which was a real firm that had some unencumbered assets. So they keep extending trade credit and this and that and the other thing, and yet they're dealing with a company which, from their standpoint, is completely assetless.
Your Honor, if I might take the first issue you raised, the $500 that was placed into the agreement. This agreement and this transaction was between two separate entities. The buyer, Kevin E. Smith Enterprises, number one, informed Crown Stock.
Look, it's just $500. I don't care what the forms are. It's $500. He puts in $500, and the unsecured creditors lose any chance of ever getting a penny without being informed about the transaction, so they might decide no more trade credit for Crown.
The creditors were actually paid for a long period of time.
Oh, for a long period of time. But you're not saying the trustees are representing nobody, right?
Oh, no.
There are a lot of there are unsecured creditors who can't collect a penny because all the assets were encumbered by Mr. Smith with his $500.
If I could just add something to Judge Posner's statement. You initially required a personal financial statement from Smith to ensure that he had the means to provide the promised $500,000 to $800,000. But then somehow you allow the closing to proceed, although Smith provides only $500. Why should you be rewarded when $500 would have raised flags in a great school kid? I'm really having a terrible time with that as well.
Well, the answer to that is that the sellers didn't know that he was not putting the $500,000 to $800,000 into the company. It was his company. The sellers did not own any portion of the buyer. The closing would have occurred, the sellers would have been paid, and the $500,000 to $800,000 that was supposed to go into the company to serve as working capital that the buyer promised to put in was never put in. But the sellers would have no reason to know that. The sellers are no longer owners of any company other than Crown Stock Distribution, which at that time was not an operating entity. And so at the time that the $500 or the $500,000 goes in, there's no knowledge on the seller's part. The problem with saying now the sellers are going to get rewarded is the sellers are not getting rewarded in this matter. The sellers did not get paid their full amount, and on top of that, the implication is that in an asset sale between two separate companies, when a buyer may not want the seller to know what they're going to do with the assets, the buyer can say, I don't want you to know. I'm going to put this money in. And the seller has really no way of confirming that it happens. But at the same time, the buyer the seller is being held responsible.
The essential point is that all of these assets become encumbered without notice to the unsecured creditors who keep extending credit. And I don't know how that kind of operation can be permitted.
Well, the unsecured creditors, when they the new company
There's no new company. That's just a formality. It's the same company. And it's the same company, and the unsecured creditors assume it's the same company. You think you can get out of the, leverage buyout characterization just by calling something an asset sale rather than a stock purchase?
No. I think that an asset sale can be a leverage buyout. There's no doubt about it. However,
a leverage buyout is where the buyer finances the purchase by pledging the assets of the company he's buying, which is exactly what happens here.
There's actually value being exchanged between the parties in this case. The value.
What is the value to Crown? Well, I don't understand. How does it get value from the $500? I don't get that.
Well, before the transaction, Kevin E. Smith Enterprises, which was the debtor, Kevin E. Smith Enterprises owned nothing. At the end of the transaction, it owned $4 million worth of assets.
For $500?
Well, it also is obligated on a note to Farmers and Merchants for that amount.
Farmers and Merchants put up money, yes. Kevin Smith Enterprises didn't put up money.
Kevin Smith
Enterprises pledges the assets of the, you know, acquired firm to the bank, right? That's not giving value. How's that giving value?
The value that's transferred from Kevin Smith to Crown stock distribution was $3.3 million. The value that was transferred from Crown stock distribution to the debtor was $4 million worth of assets.
Well, what value did Crown stockholders give up in this transaction?
The value that the stockholders gave up was that they had an entity that was operating at a profitable level. They voted, let's sell the assets. We will sell them for a certain price. We no longer will be able to use those assets to operate a business. Two of the main operations people of that were also owners signed non-compete agreements, and often non-compete agreements are not seen as giving value in a leveraged buyout because the company already had the agreement of its shareholders not to compete. But in an asset sale, when there are two separate companies here, that's not the case. So there was real value given up by the shareholders. And if I may move from the value that was given up to the result of this transaction and how the recovery should operate in this case, if there is to be a recovery, the goal of the bankruptcy estate is, or the goal of the bankruptcy code through its recovery section, is to put the debtor into the place it would have been had this transaction never occurred. There are multiple ways to do that, two specifically, one of which is Section 550A of the Bankruptcy Code. The courts have been...
Had the transaction never taken place, these unsecured creditors would presumably have been paid.
If I may, Your Honor, you had mentioned $1.5 million of unsecured debt that the company took on. The vast majority of the $1.5 million.
How much is the trustee asking for?
The trustee asked for the full amount, so it was $3.3 million with post-judgment interest.
Well, the trustee can't get more than the unsecured creditors want, right? So does that mean there's $3.3 million in unsecured credit?
No, there is not $3.3 million in unsecured credit.
What's the trustee going to do with the rest of the money, then?
That's a good question, Your Honor.
How much unsecured credit is there?
It's difficult to tell, and I'm...
Well, that's ridiculous. It's a bankruptcy proceeding. The trustee is... representing the unsecured creditors.
That's
the record,
right.
Show how much the unsecured creditors are owed.
We've asked on multiple occasions. I looked at the document.
Asked on multiple occasions. Well, you don't know what the trustee is asking for?
No, the trustee is asking for $3.3 million.
Well, you don't know, but
the amount
trustee
of
can't get... A trustee gets money and distributes it to the unsecured creditors. What's he going to do with the balance?
That...
Pay it to himself or what?
That's a good question. Looking,
well, honestly,
no,
you must know.
No, the docket. I think that's right. I don't know because I looked at the last date of filing in this case was in 2008, and the docket sheet has not been updated. The claims register has not been updated, and it still lists $8.9 million of liabilities in this case. The $8.9 million includes claims by the seller, claims by Farmers and Merchant, they've all been gone away. The best I can tell, there's really about $400,000 in trade debt left in this case to be paid.
Well, trade debt isn't the only form of unsecured debt.
That's right.
Debt.
And then there are taxes that come up to about $1.2 million is the best I can tell.
$1.2 million in taxes?
Yes.
Well, that's $1.6 million. That's not a trivial amount.
No, it is not a trivial amount. And the taxes, most of the taxes that arose...
And it's the, amount that, this $500 transaction, you think, eliminated any recovery for these unsecured creditors.
But looking to the recovery here, under 550A, the 550A has been interpreted almost universally to allow a credit for the value that was given to the transfer to the debtor. In this case, if $4 million was given to the debtor, there should be a credit for that $4 million under 550A. And if that occurs...
Which wipes out the unsecured creditors?
It would depend. Now, the judgment...
Is it your view that this credit you think your clients are entitled to can be used to wipe out the claim of the unsecured creditors?
Yes, it can be.
Well, I don't buy that.
But the judgment amount...
I don't see how this $500 transaction should be allowed to wipe out the claims of unsuspecting unsecured creditors.
The judgment amount, if there is to be a judgment, was $3.3 million. At the very least, it needs to be reduced, or should be reduced, to the amount that the unsecured creditors actually lost, which in this case might reduce it in half. Then the 550A can provide a credit, and that's where the...
I don't think so. That's the way you wipe out that's how you wipe out the unsecured creditors. I don't get that.
Your Honor, I'm into my rebuttal time, unless there's...
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Finger?
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Finger, and I represent the trustee in this matter, Mr. Boyer. And as Your Honor has described, for the sum of $500, Mr. Smith was able to gain control of this company, and the shareholders were able to monetize their investment in this company and to the tune of about $3.3 million. It's important to point out the timing of the sale and the events going on in the business. In early 1999, there was a deal struck for the sale of the business. Mr. Smith was brought on shortly before that to participate in the management of the business. In the years prior to 1999, the net sales were in the order of $4.5 to $4.8 million. In the year 2000, net sales were about in the order of $4.8 million, and then they began a precipitous decline. In 1999, however, net sales were $7.1 million. That was accomplished by emptying the backlog of orders and accelerating other orders in order to achieve that unusual result in compared to other performance. That also resulted...
Why is this important?
It reflects what the shareholders understood what they were doing with respect to their business. That let them take $600,000 out of the business before it was sold. So what was sold was the ongoing concern, less that $600,000 or $590,000.
That's your dividend. That's the dividend concern.
Yeah, that's the dividend, Your Honor.
Discuss that.
And so they took the cash out of the business, they transferred the assets and turned it over to Mr. Smith, which, as the bankruptcy court found, had a value of no more than $4 million. Digging a little deeper, he also found that the real estate had a value of about $1.5 million, and that's exactly what the price was paid for by Smith Enterprises.
Why don't you address the argument of your opponent? You're bringing up other things which are in your brief, which is fine, but why don't you respond to Mr. Holman?
Well, Your Honor, we'd start with reasonably equivalent value. That wasn't provided here. The assets had a value of $4 million, or no more than $4 million, but really they were $2 million in what would be called hard assets, equipment and real estate. And the rest was what the bankruptcy judge Grant described as a premium over that. And he, I think for the sake of ease, said no more than $4 million. But the reality is the record reflects that the purchase price was $6 million. So $6 million was paid, and no more than $4 million in assets came in, and those were completely encumbered.
It sounds pretty formalistic. The $6 million was paid. The promissory note was pretty weird promissory note, right, with the growing principal and so on, because the annual payment was less than the interest expense.
Well, the minimum annual payment was less than the interest expense.
I don't understand why this is important.
Could I try it a whole different way for a minute, please? Here the debtor had full access to the financials for the company and even was hired to work at the company before the sale, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, so that he would be aware of the inner workings. And the debtor misrepresents how the deal was being financed. He falsely indicated he would be providing between $500,000 and $800,000 personally, when in actuality, only $500 was financed. Given that level of transparency by the seller and that kind of deception by the debtor, how do we say that the seller was engaged in a fraudulent transaction here?
Well, Your Honor, we look at it, and the trustee views it in the manner of standing in the overshoes of the unsecured creditor. So it's from that perspective that the fraudulent transfer claim is brought and the transfers are sought to be avoided. I think Judge Grant found that neither side had subjective bad faith. Neither one was attempting to defraud the other. But the fact that Mr. Smith really was not proved to be incapable of running the business is unfortunate, but it's the unsecured creditors that suffer here, and the trustee steps in the shoes of the unsecured creditors to protect them. From their perspective, there was no change in this business. At some point in 2000, certain customers or vendors, it's unclear who received the letter informing them that Mr. Smith was taking over control from the Stroops. Characterize the Stroops as retiring and turning the mantle of leadership over to Mr. Smith. But that's all that some of those unsecured creditors would know of the transaction. So from their perspective, they're completely unprotected. As Judge Posner had pointed out earlier, they think they're dealing with a company with real assets that's a going concern, and there's some value there, when in reality they're dealing with a company that has declining sales, that it has all of its assets encumbered twice over, and it's completely incapable of satisfying its obligations going forward. So from that perspective, Your Honor, from that of the unsecured creditors, this is a transaction that needs to be avoided and recovery is sought from those who receive the transfers.
Could you say something about the dividend issue? I found that unclear in the briefs.
With respect to the leveraged buyout, Your Honor? Or it's a fraudulent transfer. It's not a transfer from the debtor to Crown Stock Distribution.
So I think the argument is that the dividend was paid before the, well, it was paid at the same time as the sale of the company. But so their argument is that it just reflected earnings prior to that and had nothing to do with the transaction. Is that their argument or what? Well, what is your argument about that?
Our argument, Your Honor, is that it served to take cash away from the business's ongoing concern. Both plaintiff and defendants in this matter agreed that immediately after the transaction, the company didn't have sufficient cash flow to conduct its business.
So you tie the dividend to the leverage buyout. Is that at your cross appeal? You
yes,
want to characterize leverage.
Yeah,
because
yes,
it's
Honor.
A leverage buyout. Yeah, it would just be another part of the way of paying the existing shareholders with the assets of their company.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. And what was done was by virtue of the form that was set up by having the holding company do the purchase rather than the Crown Stock Unlimited as it existed prior to the transaction, was an attempt to sort of separate those things and separate the hard assets from the cash that was in the business, distribute the cash to the shareholders, and then convey the assets which were going to be encumbered to get more money out of them. So that in this sense, it's not a transfer from the debtor to Crown Stock Distribution and then subsequent transfer to the shareholders. It's from Crown Stock Distribution to the shareholders. So in that sense, it's beyond the reach of the bankruptcy trustee.
Is Mr. Holmes' estimate that you're trying to collect about $1,600,000 for the unsecured creditors, is that correct?
My understanding reflects Mr. Holman's in that the docket hasn't been updated since 2008, so it's unclear. That number sounds right to me, Your Honor. I don't have a precise number. What I would also add is that the cost of administration of the estate is something that has been borne by the unsecured creditors.
But you can't get more money than the unsecured creditors and the cost of the administration, your fees, and so on. You can't get more than that, can you?
Well,
bankruptcy, or what would happen to the surplus?
Two issues, Your Honor, is whether how much the trustee can recover from the transferees and the subsequent transferees, and then what happens to the money once it's in the estate. And they can recover the full amount of the transfers under the code. Once that money's in the estate, it's distributed to all claimants. And to be candid, Your Honor, I've never encountered the situation in which there's a surplus of money in a bankruptcy estate after a resolution of all the issues.
But if there is a surplus, what happens?
To be frank, Your Honor, I don't know what the law provides there.
Uh-huh. You know, it was so difficult to read through all this because there just seems to be little, if you know, any at all, hard evidence in the record as to the value of the asset. And, you know, do we send you back for another hearing on what the value of the assets is?
No, Your Honor. We apologize if we're unclear in our briefing, but the record has a lot of information about the value of the assets. And when we speak about the assets, talking about the assets that were transferred as part of the sale, that's real estate, $1.5 million, equipment and other tangible items of about $450,000. The rest of it would be intangible items, goodwill, patents, that sort of thing. And there were some competing interests. Mr. Holman accurately represented the two competing interests, which were in the low threes, if you will, which is part of this record. Mr. Smith's accountant testified that when he valued the business in 1998, it was worth, in his estimation, between $2.7 and $3.3 million. Judge Grant, in making his finding, I think, conservatively said no more than $4 million was the value of the assets, and then he compared that to the $6 million purchase price. So in his estimation, that's all the finding that was necessary in order to make the determination with respect to reasonably equivalent value. So I think the record is
seems needlessly complex. Let me ask, was there a history of dividend payments by the company? Had paid dividends before?
I don't know what the record reflects that, Your Honor.
It's very rare for small companies to pay dividends, right?
Yes,
they
want
to pay they pay salary to everybody.
It is a family-owned business, and many of the family members were employed and took a salary in that sense, which is common in these types of businesses.
Although I think it'd be interesting to know whether there was a dividend history. If there was none, it certainly would strengthen your argument about its being, you know, not a genuine dividend, but just another way of squeezing cash out of the transaction to beat the unsecured creditors to the punch.
As you stand there today, Mr. Finger, do you believe that this was salary, or do you believe it was dividend?
Do I believe that the $600,000 or $590,000 was I believe that was a dividend. I believe that the those who were employed during 1999 continued to draw a salary. The dividend was made immediately prior to the sale. and that essentially took out a lot of the cash that was necessary to operate the business going forward.
And did it go to only the family members?
The record indicates how it was broken down, but it was broken down, I believe, along the respective interests that each family member held in.
So it is. It's the family members.
Yes, Your Honor. And some people have different last names. I can't speak to whether they're
wives,
truly family members. But yes, but it's a closely held business in which.
Does everyone agree that if this is properly characterized as an LBO, then the appellants lose? Is that common ground among everybody?
I don't think we've crossed that bridge, Your Honor, simply because it hasn't been acknowledged as an LBO. That would be the trustee's position. The trustee's position is that under 544 and then 550, the $3.3 million recovery is appropriate. It's also the trustee is also attempting to get the $590,000. In order to do that, it needs to.
No, I understand your dividend claim turns on the LBO, but my question was, if once a pretended acquisition is characterized as an LBO, then does that mean that the shareholders have no protection. The sellers have no protection.
That's the trustee's position. I, to be fair to Mr. Holman, I don't.
Is there case law on LBOs that get into bankruptcy?
There are plenty of cases that address a transaction as an LBO and then apply the law of fraudulent transfer under the code, such that. What would happen is that the transaction would be collapsed,
right?
And then the distribution.
So it's treated as a purchase of shares, or how, when it's collapsed, what is it collapsed into?
It would be collapsed into essentially the shell company that was set up. There was a pre-transaction shell company, Kevin E. Smith Enterprises, and then.
Don't worry about that. Yeah. So no, I'm not talking about this case. I think this. You know, you make a strong argument. This is an LBO, after all. Do we know exactly what Smith's role was in the original Crown Company when he went to work there before the transaction?
The record has.
Was he running it, or was he? He was a manager, manager level. Did he have an official position?
He did, Your Honor. He did. As I stand here, I don't know what the title was, but he did have an official role.
He's an insider. He's an employee, and of course that's the standard way in which an LBO works. You know, you have the management, and it's buying the company with the company's assets. That's basically.
Right.
So, I'm sorry.
So when that happens, and then the company, the new company, or the bought out company, if it goes broke, then you just ignore the transaction and you assume the assets are not encumbered and not encumbered by the LBO transaction, and therefore the unsecured creditors can reach them. Is that how it?
Well, it's as in this situation, Your Honor. The assets are going to be encumbered because that's the definition of an LBO. Those assets are going to be used to get the money. So that secured lender is always going to have a claim that's higher than the unsecured creditors against
the
those assets.
F&M, in other words.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what the way the transaction is unwound is then the. You can use the typical sections of the code, 544 and 548 and 550, to get to undo to avoid the transactions, the payments to the shareholders who sold. So in the, for example.
The shareholders who end up having to pay.
That's right.
Here.
For example, in the In Re Joy recovery case, a 50% shareholder bought out his partner. He was the manager. The other partner had been taking a less active role. The bank had loaned the money to the company to buy the shares, and then that shareholder took the money out, and what was left was a company that had significant encumbrances on its assets, and the shareholder took out the loan money. So that would work in this situation as well. F&M would still be secured against the assets, but
that's
those
legitimate. Yeah.
Right.
Judge Rovner, You had a question.
I did. I wondered if you could point us to any case, Mr. Finger, in which a business continued, you know, for as long as 3.5 years, but nevertheless was determined to have had insufficient cash flow as of the date of the initial transaction.
I can, Your Honor. There are... Well, I think what the cases clearly demonstrate is that each case stands on its own facts. It's just like in any situation. So there are some cases in which in the Northern District of Illinois, In Re Doctors Hospital of Hyde Park, the debtor existed for 3+ years and then was found to have unreasonably small assets. The O'Day Corporation case also existed for 2+ years and was found to have unreasonably small assets.
I know, but not a, but were those as of the date of the initial transaction? I don't think so. I think it was found somewhere along the way.
Well, I think the inquiry, Your Honor, is as of the date of the transaction, because that's how we analyze the avoidance of the transfer. So that's necessarily how it's done in these cases. In this case, Judge Grant, I thought, used the perfect line, which is they were on the Crown Unlimited was on financial life support and continued to borrow money almost immediately in order to stave off its creditors, but ultimately couldn't do so.
Well, it's a tremendous reduction because of the dividend. There is a tremendous reduction
right.
in the cash assets of the company at the moment of the transaction.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so that I think that's what he meant by the life support
right.
comment. If you have so little cash, you know, you're in the oxygen tank level.
That's correct.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Finger. So, Mr. Holman, anything further?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'd like to address your question to Mr. Finger that if this is an LBO, the appellants lose. That is not a common understanding between the parties for two reasons.
Excuse me?
That is not a common understanding between the parties, and the appellants would not agree that if this is characterized as an LBO, then the appellants would not prevail in this matter for two reasons. One, there are two cases that we've located that have dealt with a sale of assets rather than a sale of shares with respect
now,
to...
Now, you said a sale of assets can be an LBO.
It certainly can.
Cases. Give me a reason why it would make sense that where the transaction simply involves a change of control, with the shareholders being paid out of the secured loans, why that should insulate the shareholders in the event of a bankruptcy.
And I can give you a reason and a case site or a case name. The Weibolt decision out of the Northern District of Illinois.
Yeah, that's a district court decision, right? So we respect the district judges, but we're not allowed to give precedential force to a district court decision, because then you'd have too much, you know, sort of chaos. You have many different district judges in the same district. You can't accord race judicata, you know, can't accord precedential effect to each of their decisions.
I understand.
So give the reason.
The reasoning is that in a leveraged buyout that's a share sale, let's characterize this as a share sale, typically the money goes from bank to company out to shareholders. At that point,
yes, that's what happened here.
And at that point, the shareholders typically raise a 550B defense that says, I'm an immediate transferee. I'm not the initial transferee, so you can't recover from me.
Well, what's the sense of that?
Well, they often raise that, and that's why the courts
use it. What sense does it make? It doesn't make any sense.
Because 550B says that an immediate transferee can raise that defense. That's why the courts have collapsed.
Right, exactly. That's the collapse. So give me a reason why there might be an LBO case in which you didn't want to collapse the transaction to get around 550.
If there were shareholders who were not involved, had no knowledge of the voidability of the transfer, acted in good faith.
What difference does it make? I don't understand that. You're a shareholder, and someone comes along and you know screws around with the formalities in order to get the unsecured creditors off your back. Well, why should the shareholders benefit from that?
Well, any shareholder who
owns money, which really belongs to the unsecured creditors, why should they get to keep that? They haven't given up anything for it.
Well, we don't know if in a hypothetical situation, we don't know what the shareholders have given up because they've probably purchased their shares. They're not involved in this, not involved in the day-to-day operations. They have no knowledge of what's going on. Especially given
the shares, and then all of a sudden they get this big check, and they say, "Great, I have a big check." But it turns out this check is really money that belongs legally, equitably, and so on to someone else, the unsecured creditors. So what equity do they have to say, "Oh, I keep this because I didn't know what management was doing," right?
Assuming that the unsecured creditors are owed as much as the recovery is, in this case they are not, and if it's the $3.3 million and those people who did nothing wrong had no knowledge of what's going on.
I don't see what the wrongness has to do with it if it's not their money.
But the answer I can give to that is in 550B, that's the defense that they get.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.
And thank you both for speaking so loudly so that I could understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.